seen the sky so blue. The birds are singing, I got nothing to do. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's a sunny day.
Sunny day now.
My pocket's empty, my cupboard's bare. But call me illogical, I just don't care. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's just a sunny day.
Hey, 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 it's a sunny day.
It's just a sunny day.
It's the KSL Greenhouse. Expert tips for flowers, trees, gardens, and soil. Our hosts are Maria Chaleos and Ton Bettis on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. This morning we are joined by J.D. Gunnell, who is a USU Extension professor. And we've been talking about trees most of the morning, but we know people are starting to plan what they're going to be, you know, planting in their vegetable gardens, and we do have a shorter season than some places, and so it can be frustrating if you don't start early. But we wanted to start this morning and talk about ways that you can extend your gardening season, the way that you can start early and actually extend your season into the fall.
Turn your microphone on. That's the second time. Man, it's one of those mornings. So JD has a cold frame that he's been what did you call it? Puttering in?
Playing with, yeah.
Yeah, playing with.
Already?
And then a few years ago, JD and Sheridan and I put together a fact sheet on extending the gardening season, and not only just looking at how to do it, but the cost of doing it. And there's this balance that you've got to define for yourself on, yes, though having some tomatoes through late October into November is wonderful, but how much money am I willing to put into it to make it happen?
The reason I got into it is I learned to garden along the Wasatch Front in Kaysville, Layton area. And when I moved back to Cache Valley, I had to retool all of my knowledge because we're easily 2 to 3 weeks behind the Wasatch Front. I build a cold frame. I build a big high tunnel that's 24 feet by 50 feet. So it's a good size structure. But I've noticed that what these cold structures do is, one, you don't heat them, you don't cool them. That's a greenhouse. That's a full-on greenhouse. These are more passive heated just from the sun. But what I've noticed is that I can get a month earlier planting in the spring, and I can extend my season by a month on the back end, which for Cache Valley puts me right in line with the Wasatch Front. And that's what I'm used to gardening. There's a lot of things to learn. I've learned really the hard way that inside that high tunnel is easily 30 to 40 degrees warmer than outside.
During the day.
Yeah. But then at night, it still freezes and it's ambient temperature because there's no inputs.
No insulation. And it within a few hours of the sun going down, it quickly cools down. So what do you do about that?
I calm down. I try not to get too excited. This time of year, there's not a lot I can do with it. But come April, I can really start looking at warm season stuff. And it's kind of, how do I say this? Not in a hunting metaphor.
Don't make fun of cats.
No. I usually say the more lead in the air, the better the chance of getting something. And it's the same with gardening. So I've got my high tunnel. That'll give me some degrees of protection. Not a lot. But if I then put a floating row cover or a low tunnel inside of that, then there's a lot of research at Utah State. If you go to hightunnels.usu.edu, there's so much information that Brent Black and Dan Drost have put together. You can actually technically grow spinach year-round in the high tunnel. I haven't got to that point yet, number one, because I don't like spinach that much. But you can really dictate what that growing climate looks like. And this is my favorite quote from a professor ever, and this comes from Bruce Bugbee. He said, "The glory of controlled growing systems like high tunnels is you control everything." And that's actually true the other way too. The worst part about growing in climate controlled things is you're in charge of everything. So if something goes wrong, it's all you. And so it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, we have a lot of listeners that maybe don't want a big high tunnel or even a small, you know, walk-in cold frame. But there's other methods you can use to extend the gardening season. And so that would vary anywhere from something as simple as a floating row cover, which is a Rime fabric. But could you describe a little bit row covers?
Yeah, some people call them frost blankets. It's a really thin Rime, kind of like backing on a quilt, I guess. And it'll give you a handful of degrees difference. People will usually put it over their plants if it's going to freeze at night. The number one thing is you have to secure the edges because the wind will take it away like a kite. So if you secure the edges, it will actually protect your plants by about 5 degrees.
It doesn't smother them.
Well, you use hoops.
Okay, I was going to say.
Some sort of frame to hold it up.
Yeah.
Just thinking you're just spreading out this blanket out there. I'm like,
what? Like up in Cache Valley, and I don't know that they're still there. There was somebody in Cache Valley that was growing 2 acres of watermelon and cantaloupe, and they would use the hoops, the low tunnel hoops, and they would cover all of their melons when they were first seeded in mid-May with row cover. And that would give them a head start about 2 or 3 weeks ahead of when they normally would have been planted. But he was reliably getting cantaloupe and watermelon harvests using short season plants that nobody else was getting in the valley.
Yeah, and if you're doing it commercially, that's all you need is 2 weeks. And you're getting premium return on your investment.
Yeah, a Cache Valley watermelon or a Cache Valley cantaloupe. And so there's other methods, people using tires. They'll put a big tire out and then plant in the middle of the tire. And that will, especially if you cover over the top of the tire or something, there's those methods. What other things have you done to extend the gardening season?
So I've done milk jugs before over newly planted tomatoes if it was going to freeze. There's walls of water that are really easy to use. But again, the hard lesson learned that year was when it's 60 degrees outside, it's 100 degrees inside,
and I
scorched my tomatoes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's all about controlling the environment, and it's more input, but you get a little bit of return out of it.
Yeah. So before we end, I will mention that when I lived in Cache Valley, I built Victorian-era style cold frames that were just on the ground and about 3 feet tall on one end and about 2 feet tall on the other, and you garden inside of them and you use old windows or plexiglass. You helped me build them, a few of them, and we used them at the jail garden and in some other spots, but we were growing artichokes reliably up in Cache Valley. We overwintered them in the cold frame covered in straw. And that seemed to work really well, about a foot of straw. And then they were getting heat from the greenhouse. But we were getting earlier peppers and earlier tomatoes. And they can be a wonderful thing. And you talk about growing year-round in Cache Valley. One of the master gardeners had lettuce year-round in her cold frame. And it was just one of these little 3x6 window sash cold frames and up against her house. And so you can do a lot with them, but it's like having a new puppy.
Yeah, there's a lot of learning curve and a lot of maintenance.
All right. And you've put up an excellent article on the KSL
Greenhouse.
We wrote
it. So, yes, it is excellent.
It is excellent. It goes, well, the reason I didn't even notice that you wrote it, okay? But when I'm looking at it, it talks about temperature regulation and all of the different options that you have, like the cloche. A lot of people don't know what a cloche is, but you talk about cold frames.
A wall of water is actually a type of cloche.
And anyway, you've done a great job.
Thank you. Sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you.
KSL Greenhouse Facebook page, and I'll just talk over you as well. And Mike, your call is up next. When we come back, the number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. Text us 57500. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Ton and JD taking your questions at 801-575-8255. Text is 57500. Mike has been waiting very patiently on the line. Mike, what was your question this morning?
Yeah, I had a horrible infestation of aphids in my grapes last year, and I've been growing them for about 15 years. That's the first year I've had aphids, and I could not control them. Using soap spray. And so I'm wondering if using dormant spray will help that. And then what you'd recommend for control later on in the year as the grapes are on.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. First, thank you for hanging on. People from Santa Quinn don't hang up on the program. They just don't. And so, also, you didn't have aphids, most likely. It was probably grape leaf hopper, which you can control the eggs with a soap, but because they are almost like an outdoor version of fungus gnats, they do a lot more damage. But the growth pattern, you know, if you had little flies flying around in your grapes and you tapped up against them, that's grape leaf hopper.
Yep, that's what it was.
And so what you can do, unfortunately, you usually at least one time need a potent spray. And so something like the Garden Tech 7, which is really permethrin, or something similar, a permethrin spray, High Yield has one. But you're going to need, as soon as you start to see them show up, you have to spray the undersides of the leaves and get that spray inside of there because they're not on the tops of the leaves. But once you hit them with a more potent spray, then you can back off to something like a horticultural soap or something with pyrethrins in it. And like a triple action, but you would have to monitor. And if you start to see them flying around in there, you immediately go in with that more friendly spray after you've used the permethrin and keep them under control. They are manageable, but you do have to monitor and make sure that you are spraying inside. And so if you haven't been pruning your grapes, that makes things more difficult because the leaves are so dense, it's hard to spray in there. And so I don't know if you've been doing regular pruning or not, but even thinning the dead wood out, once you're kind of aware where the living branches are and the dead are, will help.
Yeah, I've been pruning them. Would you use the dormant spray this spring?
It might help a bit, but it's not going to eliminate them. The grape leaf hopper over the last 10 years has been something we hardly ever saw to being a very common pest. Okay. I don't know if you have them up in Cache Valley.
No, but in Kaysville we would have them, but they're fairly cyclical. We would have them a couple years and then they would go away. So, yeah, just monitor. And it's one of those things where you don't fix it until it's broke. When you start seeing them, that's when it's treating time.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Mike, thanks for your call this morning. Thanks for being patient with us. Next listener says they love aspen trees, but they know from listening to the show that they don't do very well here. They say they've seen some trees in Eagle Mountain that look like aspens. They think that they're birch trees, and they're wondering if those do well in Utah. They say they're really tall.
No, the aspen will do better than the birch, but they're both probably a no-go on my list.
Anything that you would suggest that they could use that would look kind of like that?
The one thing, it doesn't have the same shimmery leaves and things, but I've been recommending the, what's the Sentinel Oak? There's an oak that only gets about 6 wide and about 25 tall.
Crimson Century.
Crimson Century Maple, maybe. What is the name of that oak? I'll remember the name on break, of course, but there are some columnar trees you can use. You know, people think Swedish aspens are better. They're not.
They're skinnier, but they still sucker.
And they die within 20 years, usually.
Yeah, quakeys are beautiful. I mean, they are a state tree since 2014. It bumped off the spruce, but they're good above 6,500 feet.
Yeah, Mike wrote a fact sheet several years ago on how to manage aspen in the yard if you want to. And you can look up that fact sheet and have an aspen grove, but it is under the concept that you thin them every 15 years or so. As the tall ones start to fade out, you cut them down and you're aware that they are going to sucker. And so you designate, and so you have an aspen grove, and it still might get into the lawn, but it's under that theory. But there is a USU fact sheet on managing aspen in the yard.
But I guess the short answer is no. There's nothing that really
looks
like an aspen or a birch with that nice white bark.
Next listener has two globe willows. They think both of them have willow blight. What can they spray on them? And is there anything else I can do to help them, like fertilizer?
So willows are in the same category as quaking aspen. They grow super fast, and they have really porous wood. which makes them very susceptible to multiple diseases and multiple insect pests. So, on top of that, willows have really weak connected bark.
Especially globe willow.
They're very weakly connected, and so you'll get a lot of breakage. My advice would be not to waste a lot of money on sprays, because you'll be spraying every weekend with the host of pests and diseases. I would just enjoy it as much as you can, as long as you can, knowing that it's probably a short-term tree.
I suspect that it has bacterial wetwood in it, and you have to cut the bark away to the wood and then spray it daily for 30 days, either with a rubbing alcohol solution or 10% bleach that you mix up every day, because it loses its effectiveness after a while. Lysol itself, but you have to spray it every day for 30 days, and you have a 50-50 chance of getting rid of the infection. That's only if it's right under the bark. If it's in the heartwood, you won't get rid of it.
Jeez.
All right. Next listener wants to know what they can do to get the lawn on the north side of their home to grow. They say they have the soil is heavy clay on the east side of Kaysville. They're wondering if there's some kind of seed or will fertilizer help.
So that I had the exact scenario at my house in Layton. I lived in an area that was heavy, heavy clay. The lawn would get really thin. It got powdery mildew every year. I even got rust on a couple of years. So technically, there's not a lawn that will thrive in shade unless you're talking about fine fescue. And that doesn't even thrive. It just exists. So I actually sprayed out my lawn, put some pavers, walking path, and I created a shade garden. I have hostas and other shade-loving plants, and it looked so much better than a thin lawn. So I would kind of think outside the box. Is there other options besides lawn in that area that you could get along with?
The fine fescues, the red fescues, same grass, require about 4 or 5 hours of good sunlight a day.
All right. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. Phone lines are open. You can also text us at 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Maria Chaleos, Ton Bettis, and J.D. Gunnell taking your questions this morning. You can call us at 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. Next texter wants to know, since it's warmer than usual, is pre-emergent for troubled areas in the lawn needed sooner this year?
Probably not. The weeds that the pre-emergents are going after are based on soil temperatures. And so the ambient temperatures fluctuate a lot sooner than the soil temperatures will. Now, that's not to say that it won't. If it keeps up, the soils could warm up quicker. But the weeds that you're seeing right now, I've seen a ton of annual bluegrass. I've seen fillery popping up already.
Oh, fillery will bloom all winter on the Wasatch Front.
Yeah, but those are fall annuals. So they germinated last fall, and they've just been sitting under the snow waiting. So the pre-emergents wouldn't go after those anyway.
No, and I've seen some landscape companies or maintenance companies have hundreds of customers, and they will start putting down pre-emergent sometimes in mid-March. And if you're a customer of one of those customers, companies, you just have to work with their schedule.
Right.
Is it the ideal time? No, it's not. And I definitely would not be doing it now. It's barely February.
Like, but that's you personally doing
Yes.
Where you take yourself out of the mix, you kind of just are.
If you've hired a company, you work by their schedule. And mid to late March, you're okay. The ideal timing on the Wasatch Front's actually mid-April usually.
I usually tell people it's around tax deadline time. I hate taxes and I hate weeds, and they coincide the same
they
day.
They do. I mean, if you really
that's a great way to remember it.
want to get technical, you can get a kitchen thermometer and stick it in the soil in several areas of your yard. And when the soil is approaching about 50 to 55 degrees, that's the time to get the pre-emergent down.
Yeah, but do that in the either early morning or in the afternoon when no neighbors are watching you throw.
And your wife's not catching you taking her kitchen thermometer and sticking it in the dirt.
You need your own thermometer.
I actually have a few of them. They're only $2 or $3 each.
All right. So next person, the plant of the week was a smoke bush, and this person has a question about that. They say their smoke bush needs to be fuller, and they've read that what you said, prune low. But they say whatever they're doing has failed, and they say their bush is about 3 years old. They want it to be fuller. What should they do?
So that's where the heading cuts would come in. That's just the shortening cuts. when you take the tip off of a branch and shorten it, that stimulates the bud growth beyond it. And so heading cuts will encourage thicker growth in the middle. So, yeah, just shorten those long branches to a bud that's out facing, and that will stimulate lower bud growth.
Okay, next listener wants to know when to treat rose bushes that had a lot of aphids last year. Also, one had powdery mildew. What should they use and when should they spray?
Systemic. Mm-hmm. You know, the easiest thing to do is when those roses start breaking dormancy and you see the bud growth, just get a rose systemic from one of the garden centers that will go after insects and fungal diseases, and that'll help.
It's like a three-in-one. It's a fertilizer, fungicide, and an insecticide.
Then if you do see powdery mildew showing up in the spring, you may have to use a fungicide that is registered for powdery mildew. Daconil is not, but there's others out there. Fungenex from Scotts is, the High Yield has a few of them, but you may have to do some supplemental spraying if we're cool and wet.
Next listener wants to know, when should Rose of Sharon be pruned?
Mid-March. It's a summer blowering, words are hard today.
I know, I've had the same issue.
It's almost, man.
Combining the words together. So.
Yeah, at any rate, because Rose of Sharon blooms on new growth, if you renewal prune and give it a light haircut, you increase the number of flowers that you have that year because it's blooming off new growth.
Okay, next listener wants to know, is using root tone advised or not on burrow's tail cuttings?
It's not going to hurt anything.
What is that?
Burrow's tail is just a succulent that kind of it weeps down. It's a trailing plant.
Oh, donkey tail.
Donkey tail is another name for it. But yeah, you can use root tone. You may not need to, but you're not going to harm anything if you do.
Yeah, succulents, usually you just put them on the ground and they'll grow and they'll grow roots.
JD, one of your fans wants to know, are you still going to do garden guys and gal?
I'll let Sheridan answer that next week.
Okay, Sheridan will be here next week. We'll let her answer that question. Harry's on the line in Salt Lake City. Good morning, Harry. What is your question?
This question is for JD. I have two cashmere cedars astride a Shalimar cedar. They were planted 16 years ago, all three. They have a west exposure, and late last spring, I noticed that about a 20-foot segment from the top of the one cashmere just lost its needles. And then late summer of 2023, the other cashmere cedar lost a similar section from the top. What could be the cause of this dropping of their needles?
You could have a tip borer. It may pay to have a certified arborist come out and take a look and see if they could find that insect. Obviously, it's going to be higher up, so you won't be able to do it from the ground. But typically, when you lose the tip out of those cedars, it may be insect-induced.
An insect infestation. Okay, so a certified arborist would probably have to determine that, huh?
Yep. So just do a Google search for Certified Arborist Utah. It'll pull up a list of names that are certified.
Thank you very much.
All right, Harry, thanks for your call this morning. Next listener is Chad, and he gardens in Ogden, and he wants to know Chad wants to know about the gardener in Ogden that's growing citrus trees through the winter.
There was an article. It's been all over social media about a person growing citrus in the winter, and there was like, oh, it's easy, more people should be doing this, but we are not going to be developing a citrus industry in northern Utah. It's a hobby thing. Yeah, you can do it, but even with what the gentleman was doing, there are a lot of inputs and it is costing money. And so, I mean, you can get on, you know, if you went to Google News and just searched Utah citrus trees, it would bring the article up. I think it might have been in the Standard Examiner. But it's fun to do, and it's really neat when you see people do that. But I want to temper people's expectations. You're not just going to sling an orange tree in your cold frame or even your greenhouse and just have it go.
It's To put it in perspective, we both have master's degrees and neither one of us grow citrus.
And a lot of experience in industry and also with teaching and things, and it's just...
it's not worth it.
Yeah, and so for a hobbyist that's put his life into learning how to do it, that is different than what we're doing, and we're kind of going for the casual hobbyist here, because anything's possible if you put enough inputs into it, but it's not easy.
Okay, next listener says their Japanese Zilkova has not lost most of its leaves yet. Is that a problem?
So we've seen that a lot the last few falls, where we go from a really mild temperature to freezing really rapidly. And what happens is those leaves just freeze on the tree. It's not a big deal. When the new buds start to push in the spring, it'll knock those leaves off. I would worry more if we had a more humid climate, like the Pacific Northwest. That's where a lot of fungal diseases could grow. But where we're so arid in Utah, I wouldn't worry about it. If nothing else, it's providing a little insulation for those buds.
Derek wants to know, when is the best time to aggressively cut back gamble oak?
So it sounds like with the word aggressive.
Is that mowing it to the ground? Or?
Well, he started out talking about the smoke bushes and then ended up with gamble oak. So
gamble oak typically don't need any human intervention at all. If he's doing some aggressive pruning, what he's going to experience is a lot of sucker regrowth. Mm. And he probably won't like the results.
I know of somebody in Pleasant Grove that put Gamble's Oak in their park strip, and they aggressively prune, and they maintain the Gamble's Oak as an 18-inch ground cover.
Wow. Again, everything's possible, but especially when we start talking natives, with like Gamble Oak and Big Tooth Maple, mm-hmm. and some of those that are just natively here, they do better without human interaction. When we get phone calls at the extension office about scrub oak doing poorly and dying, 100% of the time, not even 90, it's people started watering it and it just went downhill. And so same goes for pruning. You can prune out anything that's in your way. I guess if it's around a lawn area and it hits you in the head when you mow, you can do that. But anytime I hear aggressive and pruning together, I want to tell them to just like back up, take a minute, breathe. Because again, remember the 20 to 25% on any given ornamental at any given time.
All right. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. You can text us 57500. Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the final segment of the KSL Greenhouse Show. Number to text us your questions, 57500. You can also call us at 801-575-8255. We have Keith, who's on the line in Payson. And good morning, Keith. How can we help you this morning?
Yes. I bought a house in Payson maybe about 3 years ago, and it had some trees in the back. It has a great big evergreen. I'm going to cut it down. I want to do some landscaping. But I have two almond trees, and they shed literally thousands of almonds, you know, every year. And they're nice trees, and I'm kind of debating if I should take them down, but I don't really like the mess. They're probably about, maybe 15 feet high. And there are about two of them, about 10 or 12 feet apart, but it makes such a mess.
Are the fruit splitting open and you're actually ripening the almonds?
No, I just don't mess with it. I mean, my yard's, because of the drought, I haven't done
a
whole
lot. Oh, there are so many gardeners just cursing you right now.
They're jealous first.
Yeah. You're like, you've got almonds and what? So you treat them like peach trees. And you can actually prune them pretty hard.
Are you asking whether you can take them out?
You want to remove them or reduce the size?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I would like to kind of redo my yard, but if my understanding is almond trees are kind of rare, aren't they?
They are. State? They're hardly hardy, and our growing season isn't long enough usually, unless you live on one of the bench areas, for them to ripen.
Right.
But all that being said, it is your yard.
Exactly.
And they're not puppies.
they're a nice tree. You know, it's not super shady, but they look okay.
I will tell you this. They are susceptible to all the same pests as peaches. And if you don't want to maintain them, I actually would do the pruning cut at the base.
Okay. And I just don't have the time. I mean, is it hard to harvest almonds? I mean, I've never even thought about it. All I know is there's a big mess out there.
Well, they'll ripen in early October, and what will happen is the fruit starts to drop, it splits open, and then you can get the almonds out. And you could harvest a few of them and see if they are actually, the pit is filling, and you have a seed in there, which is the almond. And if not, I mean, there's no reason, but it's going to be susceptible to greater peach tree borer, peach twig borer, and just this, you know, the peach leaf curl. Anything a peach gets, the almond will too.
All right. Well, the truth be told, nothing's killed them yet, and it just gets worse every year as far as these almonds drop.
You probably have All-in-One or Hall's Hardy. And, you know, I would look up some almond fact sheets just on harvest and things and see if it's something you want to do. But if you don't want to maintain them, you know, it's just because of their susceptibility to the diseases and things in orchards in close proximity, then I would go ahead and plant some different trees that are lower maintenance.
Okay, maybe we'll just do that, because I have people come over and they say, "You got almonds?" You know, they just can't believe I've got almond trees in my backyard.
Just the way it works. If you don't want them, you have them.
I mean, this completely, again, kind of goes against the grain, but if you wanted to get rid of the fruit, if you sprayed the flowers with a dormant oil, that would scorch every last flower off, and you'd get no fruit.
Oh, well, that's an idea. Okay, well, maybe I'll try something like that. So,
all right, Keith. Thanks so much for your call this morning. Next listener says they're helping friend plant a tree next month, but the ground is very rocky. They're going to probably need a pick to do that. They want to know, it will a tree do well in a in ground like that? It's got a lot of rocks.
Rocks are a bugger to dig in, but trees love them. The roots have a lot of aeration, a lot of penetration. So just think, the harder it is for you to dig, the more the tree will like it.
Ooh, okay. Next listener says they've never put down fall fertilizer on their lawn. Is it okay to do it now while there's no snow on it?
No. I don't know that it would hurt anything. You'd just be wasting money.
The nitrogen's just going to leach away because the roots aren't really actively growing. The earliest fertilizations we usually do are sometime in late March, and that's with a pre-emergent. If you don't need pre-emergent, the recommended timing here for your first fertilization is late April to May.
Usually about, we were talking about forsythia and lilacs. It's about when it's between the two when you're fertilizing.
James in Syracuse is wondering about pruning peach trees. He says it seems like the pruning season is getting later in the winter now.
Don't trust the warm weather we've had and stick with that mid-March recommendation. If you have to prune, if temperatures stay above 10 degrees at night for a week to 10 days, and so you're going to have to use the weather prognosticators to look at that.
Is that a word?
Prognostication, it just means prediction.
Wow.
I just wanted to sound fancy.
It's Saturday morning and he got that out.
That is awesome. Yeah.
So the key is it has to be above 10 degrees for about a week to 10 days after you prune. And you don't want to be in the 60s dropping to the 30s because you need to let those trees re-harden to the cooler weather. And so the orchards start pruning right after Christmas, but they start with the apples and pears and the tart cherries.
But the reason they do it is they have thousands of trees.
They do, and those trees are more tolerant, and they'll work their way into the peaches sometime into mid to late February, but they even hold off on pruning the peaches as long as they can.
Okay, guys, we have a couple minutes left, and I'm going to live dangerously and take this last call from Robert in Kaysville. Good morning, Robert. What was your question about lawn care?
Well, I've got in my front lawn, I have a huge yard in back. My lawn looked really great. And then last summer, I got two brown sprouts in them. And these are huge sprouts. One maybe 8 foot in diameter, and then another one away from it that's probably 3 or 4 feet in diameter. And I have no idea, because the rest of the lawn looks great, I have no idea what it is.
So you didn't change your watering or anything?
No. No, and one is close to where I taken a tree out, but that tree was out a couple of years ago.
So
and to, but some, Somebody told me that was grubs, but I have no idea.
Well, grubs is kind of like people say pine. There could be a lot of different insect species, but my guess is probably insect related, because if it showed up in the heat of summer, that's when the insects are active. Not to say that they're still there. You could just overseed that area, and because the grass, once the crown is dead, it's not going to grow back in that area. So you'll have to seed it. And then watch. Okay. If those areas grow, then you do have an active insect problem.
And if those brown spots do show up, when they do show up, try pulling the brown grass up gently but firmly. If it pulls out really easily, then it is insect related.
And if it's not, if it doesn't, then...
It's either irrigation or fungal. And if it's fungal, you want to send a sample up to the USU Pest Lab.
Okay, and they would give you separate areas like that. They didn't seem to grow bigger. They just almost started that size. And but boy, like they were right dead.
Yeah. Try pulling it up. If it reappears, if it doesn't pull up, then it's probably irrigation or fungal, and you can send some samples off.
All right, Robert, thanks for your call this morning, and that is it. JD, thanks for being with us this morning.
Anytime, it's fun.
Been great talking about trees and all sorts of other things, extending your gardening season, and good stuff.
Yeah, it's been a great program. It goes quickly.
I want to remind folks that if they've missed the program, they're just tuning in, you can go back and listen to it in podcast form at kslpodcast.com. Our plant of the week was the smoke bush. You can find more information about that on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page, and have a great weekend.